thank you very much for being here this evening. Thank you for fighting the traffic. I have been asked to speak on, as you can see, sorting fact from fiction and future developments, and this is an excellent opportunity to talk to you about some of the recently released research. Very appropriate that I'm speaking the same evening as Susan Davis. Just with regard to the question about good randomised controlled trial data and hormone therapy in women, well, with an attempt to obtain the same sort of data in men, I can now speak with you about the recently published testosterone trials. So let me just talk a little bit about guidelines and prescribing, some new research, wave the flag for Australian research in this area, and then talk to you about forms of testosterone replacement therapy. Okay, so those of you with eagle eyes will appreciate that there has been a very slight change in the PBS requirements for prescribing since they were first released on April the 1st, 2015. I don't suppose anybody from my department would care to comment. The listing is actually now removed that the patient must be male if you have a look at the guidelines. So that was initially in the guidelines. So the first thing is to say, and I still get a lot of confusion from general practitioners about the requirement for testosterone levels, even in somebody who's had pituitary surgery or a bilateral orchidectomy. So the first, obviously the first comment is that if you actually do have an established pituitary or testicular condition, then you qualify for treatment. And one thing that never ceases to amaze me is that men still don't actually have a testicular examination. And David DeKretzer was a big one for saying that we can do all sorts of things, but it's amazing what happens when you actually examine the patient. And using an orchidometer, here's my plug for Andrology Australia, on the left-hand side is a gentleman who was a sperm donor with 30 mil testes. On the right-hand side is one of the gentlemen from our clinic with Klinefelter syndrome. And really, you don't need a medical degree to actually work out the difference between the two. And again, for those with eagle eyes, I know Rob McLaughlin examines without gloves. I always examine with gloves. So that's the... Oh, God, sorry, I'm going to lose everything. Hang on one sec. Right, creating havoc already. So if you have a gentleman who has established pituitary or testicular condition, then you are perfectly entitled and indeed should be treating him with testosterone therapy unless there would be any medical condition that would contraindicate that. Here's where the confusion comes in. I'm not quite sure what happens if you're 39, because you have to be 40 to be eligible for treatment. You must not have established or pituitary testicular disease, and you must not have one of the listed conditions there. I struggle with the infertility, because to the best of my knowledge, infertility is not a cause of low testosterone. There are a number of conditions that cause both low testosterone and infertility. So I do struggle that I believe these guidelines are factually inaccurate in that regard. The other difficulty is that the patient must now be treated by a specialist. Again, that is somewhat vague, and it is not clear to me that I actually see every man whereby my name is the prescribing specialist on the prescription. It's my understanding that an appointment can be made to see me, but the patient does not have to have seen me and can have a prescription written out in my name. I'm not sure what the practice of the endocrinologists or indeed other specialists here is with regard to prescribing my own informal practice. If my name is on the prescription, I think the gentleman should see me at least every 2 years, and the same applies within our androgen clinics. This is the instance whereby we need biochemical criteria with two morning testosterone levels less than 6. Again, if you go back and look at it, it's difficult to find a good database. This data is derived from work from Boo Yeep with David Handelsman, and is reasonable, but I do not think is absolutely comprehensive. And down below are the sensible listings that the levels must be taken in the morning and must be repeated. The limitations on the LH criteria criteria are somewhat arbitrary. Data published by Andrology Australia with Ken Sakaris a number of years ago showed quite clearly that whilst there are significant differences in platforms for measuring testosterone, that the upper limit of LH across most assays and for biologically reproductively healthy young men is in fact 6 international units per litre. I'm not going to speak to the issue of testosterone assays tonight, but I can make comment on that later on if you would like. The important thing to actually note is that we get quite caught up in the issue of ageing, but indeed, and this is work that came out of David Handelsman's group that we were part of, looking, the best work is always the simplest really, and this was just asking older men who thought they were in good health to come along and share the secrets of their success, so to speak, and you can see here that indeed age was not a defining criteria for testosterone levels, and as serendipity would have it, the gentleman with the highest level was one of the oldest in the study. So if you maintain good health as you age, there is no reason necessarily that your testosterone levels will fall, and Fred Wu's data from the EMAS study is also confirming this. On the other hand, however, and this really is quite old data now, when I started my PhD, we were actually looking at non-obese men with low testosterone levels, and by the time I got to the end of the PhD, realised I'd been studying the entirely wrong group of men. And you can see here that one of the most important determinants in our men weren't particularly obese is in fact body composition and obesity, and indeed Mathis Grossman has gone on to look at this work in a number of ways and has some outstanding publications looking at this. So it's important to, when we particularly look at this confusing group of older men with low testosterone levels, is actually to ask ourselves which indeed is the egg and which indeed is the chicken. And so that led recently to a so-called expert, that's unfair on my colleagues, an expert group of andrologists who have recently published in the Medical Journal of Australia an update from the guidelines from a number of years ago. Let me tell you that there's lots of argy-bargy involved in putting a document together like this, but this actually, I believe, of course I'm biased, gives a good standard place in which to look for some guidelines for assessing men who you think may be at risk of a low testosterone. I draw your attention to this particular table that I quite like the way Boo put this together. In terms of where we stand about, Rob McLaughlin always talks about physiology leading into pharmacology. So indeed, up on this side on the slide, you can see criteria for which there's no doubt about the role of testosterone therapy, Klinefelter syndrome, primary testicular dysfunction, and then other causes of hypogonadotropic hypogonism, congenital or usually pituitary disease. And then you sort of move into these greyer areas about ongoing research areas. We're looking at middle-aged and older men, and I'll come to that with the testosterone trials, androgen deficiency and chronic disease, and certainly Stella Salas is here tonight, is looking at this in the setting of opioids. Then we come into other medical conditions whereby we know men may be at risk of having a low testosterone or a lowish testosterone, and have other conditions whereby there has been shown to be a benefit for testosterone, such as osteoporosis or corticosteroid-induced bone loss. We then come into the areas that David Handelsman speaks so eloquently on, and that is misuse and, again, male infertility. It still worries me that I see referrals where it has been suggested that with male infertility, perhaps testosterone might be an appropriate form of treatment, the issue, so-called issue of male menopause. And, of course, then we come down to what we would consider to be quite clear abuse, where the intent is for supraphysiological testosterone levels to achieve an outcome, such as in the areas of bodybuilding. And I find it useful when I'm talking to men about where pharmacology and physiological replacement sometimes overlap. That's all I want to say about guidelines and prescribing, but what I do want to move on is to share with you some of the new literature around the testosterone trials. So this was, if you like, somewhat akin to the Women's Health Initiative trying to define a role, or is indeed there a role for testosterone therapy in older men. And this is a group, it's an interesting way of putting it together. So it's one overarching trial broken up into seven different components. And what it's actually trying, they're sort of, if you like, their mission statement. And I wanted to take you through this as to how this came about and why they chose the group of men they did, what the results are and how you interpret them in the light of the men that were actually studied. So they started off from a very good clinical base, and that is whether older men with low testosterone levels and symptoms that suggest low testosterone level with at least some objective evidence will actually benefit from testosterone therapy within the outcomes of these particular subgroup of trials. And so what they were looking at, they wanted to set the eligibility criteria for a testosterone that was low enough to ensure that men were unequivocally testosterone deficient. But of course, one has to recruit for a clinical trial when one starts a clinical trial. And then they looked sensibly at primary outcomes that were of the most significant clinical importance, and to try and identify what was, of course, the minimum difference that you needed to determine that in fact testosterone was going to be effective. And so in order to randomise, they had to actually physically see about 30 men to randomise one gentleman. So they used the cutoff of more than 65 years because it was a commonly used cutoff in clinical trials. And this is as per the paper that was published at the start of the trials in Clinical Trials Journal. They used total testosterone as opposed to free testosterone because it was able to be more rigorously assayed in the sites that were used. And as for determining the serum testosterone, well, they started off by stating that at 300 nanogram per deciliter is the lower limit of normal for young men, so about 10 nanomole per litre. Well, one could argue that somewhat, but that's a reasonable statement. And then on that basis, they decided that they would select less than 250, so about 8. But we're not quite sure where we got from 250 to 300 in that paper. But nonetheless, that's not unreasonable. And it was on two visits, excellent, and it was done in the morning. But after 6 months of screening, only 11.6% of men had qualified by the first test, and of those, only two-thirds then qualified by the second. So unfortunately, less than 8% of men qualified by both. So unfortunately, that's going to make recruiting for the trial very difficult. So then they revised that up to 275, the second to 300, and the mean to less than 275, so that by 3 years of screening, 20% of men had qualified on the first, 68% on the second, and 14% overall. And here indeed lies the ongoing issue that when you actually go looking for these men with low testosterone levels, they are relatively hard to find. And I remember reading a particular paper a number of years ago published by Steidel et al. Looking at testosterone therapy in older men, and effectively what it was a treatment of obesity, because these men had to have, I can't quite remember the absolute mean level, but it was well into the 30s was the average BMI. So once you actually start taking out particularly high BMIs, it starts becoming difficult to actually recruit these men. And sensibly, they had to have at least one symptom that could be consequent to the low testosterone level to be entered in one of the main three trials, which is reasonable clinically because nobody's going to treat a man who is otherwise in very good health unless he has a particularly low testosterone level. So the testosterone modality that was used, they decided they would use a gel preparation. That is indeed very sensible, and they put out requests. And so Solvay donated Androgel 1%, similar to the products that we have available here to the study. The testosterone target level was the normal range for young men, measured at the months you can see here. And then the target range initially was 400 to 800 nanogram per deciliter, and then it was increased up to 500 to 800. It's not quite clear from the text, but it was effectively that the levels weren't quite low enough that they were actually going to see a difference. When I show you the outcomes, I've converted it for you to nanomole. And of course, as you would expect, they screened for prostate disease, screened the hematocrit, a full blood count, and asked about cardiac history at each time. And you can see here the dosing regimen for testosterone according to testosterone levels. So again, from the paper, and this is the basis of the first publication in the New England Journal of Medicine, they were looking at the physical function, sexual function, and vitality function. And I've just listed there, I think it's probably readable, is the criteria for each of those there. So when it came down to recruitment, there's a lovely flow chart here taking you through, but what I will tell you is that you had to telephone screen 65 men to enrol one man, and eventually of those men screened, 1.5% were eligible and enrolled in the study. So, you know, great tenacity to continue to recruit for the trial. But again, when you think about it, we're sort of inundated with the press telling us that every man over 40 has a problem with his testosterone level. But when you actually start to pick it apart and look at recruiting from studies, and this would certainly be our experience in the past, and I will share with you some of our ongoing concerns. So really what you want to know is, what did the man who was recruited actually look like when we're trying to take the information that's published and apply it to the men that we see in clinical practice? Akin to the issue, again, of the Women's Health Initiative, where we actually had to look at the characteristics of the women and the outcome of the study to determine how applicable to that is to the women that we see in clinical practice. So this is our gentleman. So the average man in the study was 72 years of age. 90% of them were Caucasian. They had an average testosterone of 8.1 nanomolar as they were enrolled in the study. More than two-thirds of them were obese, but importantly, the BMI was only 31, so not overly obese. Most of them had hypertension, a third of them had diabetes, 15% had had an infarct previously, and 20% had sleep apnea. From a bone point of view, they had relatively well-maintained bone density, which perhaps suggests to me that none of these men had significant long-standing hypoandrogenism. And on the bottom, I've listed for you the increase in the testosterone levels. So effectively, what they achieved was a testosterone of approximately 17 nanomol per litre. Now, probably a tad higher than we might aim for in a 72-year-old gentleman, but not out of the realms of possibility, and certainly not at the levels that was in the testosterone study that showed the concern about cardiovascular risk. Okay, so what did we actually find out? Well, in terms of sexual function, the endpoint was self-reported improvement on a number of the different questionnaires. There were 790 men who were studied, and certainly you can see there an improvement in sexual function initially, but that it waned towards the end of the study. Sexual desire and erectile function were both improved, and interestingly, the incremental increases in testosterone were correlated with improvements in sexual desire and activity, but not erectile function. And that's not surprising, given that the mechanism is usually neurovascular. There was no threshold testosterone level above which there was seen to be an improvement. The accompanying editorial, however, commented that the benefits were modest. They tended to wane, I guess there's no pun really there, in the latter months of the treatment period, and as the authors noted in the discussion, were not as robust as the effect of the PDE5 inhibitors. So it's very interesting when you look at the reporting of this study, whether people choose to focus on that initial improvement or whether they focus on the results at the end of the study. What about vitality? Again, assessed by a self-reported questionnaire, testosterone had no significant benefit with respect to vitality, but the men who received testosterone reported slightly better mood and lower severity of depressive symptoms. Non-specific, not statistically significant. Okay, what about physical function? Really important part of preventing morbidity as men age. This was done objectively on a 6-minute walk test and also on the SF-36, and the patient's impression of the improvement or not in their walk performance, and again, this included all the men in the study. So the percentage of men who had an increase of at least 50 metres in the 6-metre walking test did not differ between the two groups in the physical function test, but when you looked at the men in all three of the trials, there tended to be a slight benefit. So again, a little disappointing considering we took these men with a baseline testosterone of 8 to a level of 17. So we've got a good improvement in their testosterone levels, but sadly not great benefits in these outcomes. Now, more recently published have been the remainder of the outcomes. In terms of cognitive function, this was on delayed paragraph recall. There were a number of secondary outcomes. 493 of the men were studied in this part of the work, and testosterone was not associated with improved memory or other cognitive function on any of the parameters studied. Okay, now for a little bit of good news. Looking at bone density, where they looked at volumetric bone mineral density by QCT as well as aerial bone mineral density by DEXA and bone strength, you can see that there is certainly an improvement in trabecular bone, particularly in the spine, and compared to placebo, this was a 6.8% increase. The improvement in the trabecular bone was associated with the increase in testosterone and, as one would expect, the increase in estrogen. And you always like to hang your hat on some numbers. So a 200 nanogram per deciliter, so about a 7 nanomolar improvement in testosterone led to a 6% improvement in trabecular bone. But bear in mind, these men had good bone density to start with. In terms of actual clinical outcomes, there were 6 fractures in each treatment arm in the 12 months of the study. So 211 men were included in that study, and they excluded men if they had, they're excluded from all of the studies if they had a T-score of less than 3. So that's great. But I refer you back to, in fact, the lead author, Peter Snyder's work, dating back almost 20 years now, when he looked at a 3-year trial of transdermal testosterone in men aged 65 years and over. And on a post hoc analysis at 3 years, those men with a testosterone level of less than 10 nanomolar had an improvement in their bone density. So this work is indeed consistent with previous published work. What the authors do note is that the improvement is over a shorter period of time. They comment that it may be because these men did have slightly lower testosterone levels to start, they achieved slightly higher testosterone levels, and interestingly, this is certainly not my area of expertise, but they felt that looking at bone mineral density by QCT would be more accurate because you wouldn't pick up degenerative disease and osteophytes artifactually increasing bone mineral density. So it is important, I think, to note there is a benefit here because this has certainly been shown previously. So to me, this was validation that the trial was effective, the treatment was effective, it confirms what we've previously known. But in that context, we're not seeing benefits on the, if you like, softer indications for treatment, which is often what is driving men along to their GPs to talk about testosterone therapy. Now, what worries me slightly, and David Handelsman has written an excellent editorial accompanying this paper. Now, this is, of course, a surrogate marker, but coronary artery plaque actually increased in the actively treated group by CT angiography compared to placebo, highly statistically significant after the 12 months. There were only 138 men in this part of the study. There were no major adverse cardiovascular events in either of the groups, but bear in mind this was only a 12-month study, but I think that is a worrying signal. The previous data about adverse cardiovascular effects has been difficult to interpret. The best data from the TOM trial looked at older men who achieved a very high increase in their testosterone level starting from a very low baseline. To me, that represents almost pharmacology rather than physiological replacement, but noting that the end point of that particular study was to address frailty, so the authors weren't being negligent, rather they were actually looking specifically to improve muscle mass and strength to prevent falls in elderly men. Of course, we're well aware of the observational data with the methodology that has a number of limitations, shall we say, suggesting an increase in cardiovascular risk. And I, as I know some of my colleagues are somewhat guilty of using that data to dissuade men with borderline testosterone levels and metabolic problems when I'm trying to encourage them to address the metabolic problems in the first instance. And I think this data, again, although it's only preliminary, is certainly concerning. Finally, as you would expect, there was an increase in haemoglobin and hematocrit. The men in this particular in the study had to have a starting haemoglobin of less than 12.7. Of the men, 126 were anemic, 62 of whom had no cause. I'm not actually clear what the cause was in the other men, whether it was thought to relate to their androgen deficiency, because of course men with significant comorbidities, including renal dysfunction, were included from this study. So the percent of men with unexplained anemia whose haemoglobin was the outcome was the percent of men with unexplained anemia who had a more than 1 gram increase with testosterone, and of course they achieved that. If they didn't, I'd be a little worried, because we know that that's one of the markers of testosterone. And again, I'm reminded of some of the work from David de Kretser and Steve Holdsworth dating back 30 years now, where they looked at actually treating men with renal failure with testosterone before the availability of erythropoietin. The haemoglobin was above 17.5 grams per deciliter in 6 men who were not anemic at baseline. I must admit I was a little bit surprised that it in fact wasn't higher. I know this is a transdermal preparation which we certainly preferentially use in the clinic in older men, trying to avoid the intramuscular testosterone associated increases in haemoglobin and hematocrit, but nonetheless I was surprised that there weren't more men in that category. So that's the sort of literally latest data, which I think underscores I think nicely the Australian position generally, in that go looking for men and be sure about your diagnosis of men with testosterone deficiency, but in men with who've got sort of more subtle age-related declines in testosterone, then we need to be somewhat circumspect about prescribing testosterone. The next couple of slides are pure self-indulgence because we Australians are putting our money, well, the NHMRC's money, where our mouths are, and we are in fact trying to look at this role of testosterone perhaps in a slightly younger cohort of men. So the T4DM study has just finished recruitment. The aim of the T4DM study is to look at men with low testosterone levels who are obese, who have pre-diabetes or borderline diabetes, and determine whether testosterone, in addition to a Weight Watchers program, will actually be able to prevent the progression to type 2 diabetes. And these are the groups, so pretty much everyone who's anyone in andrology, if I may dare to say that, has had their chance to have a say. And if you're not featured there, then you're probably on the Data Safety Monitoring Committee. So we're really proud of this study. We're very proud that we've actually recruited for this study. And so we're looking at a group of men that are slightly younger than we looked at in the testosterone trials. And that really is one of the answers, one of the questions I've got that I don't think the testosterone trials answered, is what about those men in their 40s, 50s and 60s that are coming along for treatment? Do the same outcomes apply for them? We too are guilty of massaging the cutoff level for testosterone into a study in order that we could recruit to the study. And just to give perhaps the younger endocrinologists thinking about clinical research insight into how these things happen, as you do, one usually only meets with one's colleagues, particularly from interstate, when one goes to overseas meetings. And the birth of this study really started in the lounge where everybody was waiting to come back from Washington, from Endo. I looked back on my emails in 2009. And thanks to Gary Wittett, this would never have happened without Gary. We in fact achieved NHMRC funding, and then we're all sort of blindsided by the fact that we will now actually have to do this study as we were back then. Southern Health got our ethics approval in December 2012, enrolled our first subjects as it is with multiple amendments to the protocol, February 2013. We enrolled our 1,000th subject on the 22nd of February, and with enrolment completed with 1,007 men. So this indeed will be the largest randomised controlled trial of testosterone therapy. And I am sure in several years' time, no matter where you are in Australia, you are going to be bored to death by us talking about our data. And this is a list from the Andrology Australia website about preparations that are currently available here in Australia. And just to remind you that everything that is prescribed here in Australia by us is a natural testosterone, so is aromatized, because of course we appreciate the importance of testosterone on bone, predominantly relates to conversion to estradiol, and there is a more small conversion to DHT as well. So when we're thinking about prescribing for our men, what are the things that we take into consideration? Well, I very rarely use testosterone undecanoate. In fact, I actually can't recall now the last time I've written a prescription. But when our transdermal preparations were more limited, sometimes in my older men who had been androgen deficient for quite some period of time and who were already taking a number of oral therapies, I might have started with a small dose of Andriol. We now have a number of gels, patches, solutions and creams that are available, and with their half-life they are applied every day. We have the old intramuscular preparations that we really don't prescribe in our clinic anymore because of the peak trough effect, certainly our younger men, going back many years when that was pretty much standard of care, used to like the peak but hated the trough. It's interesting now that we're seeing more and more men actually being prescribed these preparations. Anybody give me a thought as to why that might be? Sustanon's off the PBS and it's quite cheap, so you don't actually have to interact and wait to come to a clinic or wait and pay to see somebody privately in their rooms. And this is also important in the transgender populations where they perhaps don't want to be interacting with yet another specialist. Intramuscular testosterone undecanoate really was a game changer when that came along, and we prescribe a lot of that in our clinic. Our young guys with their Kleinfelters like to come in every couple of months and be jabbed in the butt by one of our fabulous clinic nurses, and then they walk out the door and don't think about it again. Those of you who are more senior in the audience will remember testosterone implants for men, and some of you may remember being the young registrar in clinic and it was your job to put the testosterone implants in. I do remember the fateful day one of our long-standing patients looked at me and said, "Carolyn, with all due respect, I would rather be jabbed by Elise, our fabulous nurse, than stabbed by you any time." And hence, I think that was pretty much near the last set of implants that that I put in. There are probably not in this audience because it's an interested audience, but I'm still surprised by the uncertainty about prescribing and how to use preparations by people who may not prescribe terribly often. When we're talking to men about their testosterone replacement, I say to them, well, on my side of the desk, there are the following considerations, the obvious things such as whether or not you're on an anticoagulant therapy, and then there are the factors on the other side of the desk, such as convenience, having, if they travel from a distance, having to come and see us, versus other preparations where they don't need to come and see us quite so often. And on this table lists again the different transdermal preparations that are available. I can honestly say that we've been involved at Prince Henry's, MIMR, and now the Hudson with most of these at some point in time. In particular, we actually did the original phase one work with Axiron before there was even an applicator. Some men find the underarm way of administering it very convenient. Other men just look at me like I've got two heads and don't find it particularly easy, find it a little bit messy. When Testagel came only in sachets, some of my older gentlemen, perhaps with rheumatoid arthritis, found the sachets quite difficult to manipulate, and I found were using their Axiron as sachets, and subsequently now testosterone gel comes in a pump pack, and I quite like that, I must admit, because the one dose is four pumps, so if a man has had testosterone deficiency for quite a while, I can start him off on a low dose of one pump. We also worked with Rob McLaughlin, with Lawley, looking at their cream preparations, and we found we have some of our men in the clinic who don't absorb their gels very well, who have opted to use the cream. Up until more recent times, this has been limited by a cost for them, and I will show you some of the scrotal data in just a moment. On the other hand, I must also say that we were part of the phase four work with Leandro looking at post-marketing data for them. So we've had a foot in many camps, so to speak. Again, I just briefly remind you of the contraindications and precautions in prescribing. I am somewhat more conservative in prescribing intramuscular therapy in my older men, where there is the possibility of coincident prostate disease. Untreated severe sleep apnea, there is the egg and chicken question about which makes which worse, and most of our men, many of our men in the clinic, particularly older men, have a mild degree of sleep apnea, and we simply monitor them. Polycythemia is an issue for us, again, particularly in our older men if they're smokers or they've got cardiorespiratory disease, and we find that the intramuscular preparations exacerbate this, so we're more likely to use a transdermal preparation. When our men are subjected to drug testing, we have some men who perform at elite level athletics, etc. So we're always cognizant of that. And when fertility is desired, and again, it never ceases to surprise me that there is the lack of understanding about the impact of testosterone. Our own policy in the clinic is that we've gotten to know many of our men very well over the years, and we say to them, we like when you come in and you tell us your new partner, and then the partner becomes the fiance and the relationship's more serious, and we say we're interested not because we like you as people, but we also want to know, because if you happen to be one of our young guys with their Kalmans, or you've got pituitary disease and you're on your Reandron, well, we will take you off and put you onto a transdermal preparation well in advance. And certainly we have a couple of men where they've come along to us from outside and their partners are in their early 40s and they've got secondary androgen deficiency, so we certainly will be able to work from our point of view, we're pretty certain will be able to induce spermatogenesis, but the lack of understanding that it's not like a woman coming off the pill and cycling in the next month, that it can take us 18 to 24 months, and particularly because it's always about the woman, isn't it? The female partner is a little bit older, so this lack of understanding really does cause us some distress in the clinic. So I'd just like to finish on behalf of Lawley and just show you some of the data from a recently released paper. There's a previous paper that Gary Wishart was involved in. This one was David Handelsman's group. And again, I know I've said it a few times, but we really are in an incredibly privileged position in Australia. No matter where you are, which state, you've got somebody expert in andrology. And so for some of our men, having an option of applying the creams or gels elsewhere, particularly if some of them find that if they're hairy, they don't enjoy that. If the for some of them, the Axiron is a bit messy in the axilla, then it's always fabulous to be able to have an alternative for them. Why the scrotal skin? It's got a very thin stratal corneum, so it's the obvious place for steroid permeability, and also minimises the risk of passive topical transfer, which is a concern about applying some of the other preparations, although I must admit I do find it more a theoretical concern. I always ask the gentlemen in our clinic if they ever happen to see there was a great episode of House many years ago where a brother and sister went in, had some issues and precocious puberty because dad was using the gel to improve his libido for his young partner. Well, we could now refer him to the testosterone trials and tell him it's not going to be particularly effective, but nonetheless. It makes for interesting television, but in reality, not so much an issue, particularly as most of our men tend to apply the gel in the morning before they head off to work. The pharmacokinetics of scrotal application have not been well studied. If they are going to be well studied, David Handelsman's group are definitely the group to do them, and this was a dose-ranging study to look at the pharmacokinetics. It was a single-centre, three-phase crossover pharmacokinetic study. It was three single doses in a random sequence of Androfort 5, and it was administered to healthy male volunteers. One of the important aspects of this study is that these were men not coming off other forms of treatment, but they had their own endogenous testosterone production suppressed by nandrolone. This was a single dose, so the testosterone level was looked at over 16 hours. And as those of you who are familiar with measuring testosterone, of course, again, we're very lucky that we have access to mass spec measurements for testosterone, not only in research, but now indeed at Monash, that is the assay that we are using. You may wait a little longer for your result, but it's very valid when it gets to you. There was a two-day washout in between, and these were the doses were listed as there, 1 mil, 0.5 mils, and 0.25 mils. And so there you can see that the mid-dose, the 25 milligram, gave an excellent testosterone profile. You can see there I've labelled for you 7 and 21 nanomole per litre over the 16 hours. And one of the interesting comments in the paper was that compared to abdominal skin, there was an eightfold increase in testosterone bioavailability. And of course, for some men who may be in conjunction with their prescribing physician not fit the criteria, there are important issues for some of our men in terms of cost for our preparation. So work like this adds to the armament that we have available to our men when they come along and see us in clinic. And so finally, testosterone, who, when, why, or why not, and how. We get a bit caught up in the men with the borderline levels in the male ageing debate, particularly if you read certain newspapers and in the media, men are certainly being encouraged to think about their testosterone status. But we forget that 1 in 200 men has unequivocal androgen deficiency, and we probably aren't diagnosing a lot of those men. So again, I hark back, and you too can be the proud owner of an orchidometer to assist you in your examination. Age is not a determining factor, and I think that's becoming clearer and clearer from the literature. The testosterone trials cast doubt on the widespread role of testosterone therapy in aging men as the panacea for all the effects of aging, and certainly we now have a number of tools to individualise testosterone therapy according to the concerns that we have medically, and also most importantly for the personal preferences of the men that we're treating. Thank you very much.